I'm Mariah Rooney. Welcome to Moved, the podcast where we can move and be moved together. This is a space for conversations about the moments that alter us, the raw, ordinary, and sacred stories that remind us that we belong to one another. In our first episode, I am in conversation with my friend Prentice Hemphill, organizer, teacher, and somatics practitioner. Prentice is a remarkable human who inspires me in every conversation. Prentice is a lot of things. They're a teacher, they're a somatics practitioner, they're an organizer, and those are some easy things to rattle off, maybe in terms of the professional bullet points, if you will. But beyond the titles, you know, and the ways that you move through the world professionally, I also think about the ways that you move through life as a parent, as a partner, as a friend, as a committed community member, and really a weaver and a co-conspirator in so many ways. So I just also want to share that I experience you and your work as a really necessary reminder of the centrality of our whole beings and bodies in the story of justice and the pursuit of love and liberation. And you help us remember, or for some people, I think it really is to maybe realize for the first time that embodiment, that becoming present in our bodies is both a path to resistance and to belonging. I'm so stoked to have you here.
Every time you introduce me, which has been a few times now, I just realize what a poet you are. I feel like when you introduce me, you call me into my higher self. So thank you.
That's really sweet. Thanks, Prentice. Yeah. Well, you're easy to introduce in that way. So
nice.
Appreciate it. A question that I think would be related to that in terms of how anyone listening comes to know you or know you in a different way. I'm feeling really curious how you like to humanize yourself beyond the limitations of a bio, beyond a list of bullet points. Like, what are the ways that you like to be humanized in the world and in relationship to other people?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing we seem to do as human beings where we are often trying to figure out what our status is in relationship to other people. So they're like, okay, I know what you are, or I've heard of you, or we position ourselves sometimes above or below each other. And I'm always trying to just like bring people to the ground. Like, we all get to be here, and I'm a person who, you know, has been on a certain path for a long time, but it doesn't, I'm still on a path. And, you know, I tell people, like, to me, a teacher is somebody that's maybe just been asking the question a little bit longer than you, but is still a student to the question. And I hope to be a teacher in that way. So I think that's one way to know me, as a student teacher, someone that's still asking and still learning. I'm a person that's trying to figure out how to be a friend in this life. I think that's one of my main journeys, is friendship. That's part of what I'm healing this go around. And yeah, I'm like an irreverent, deeply feeling, deeply loving weirdo.
I love weirdos, so that's a great way to wrap that part up. I'm really struck by this pursuit of embodying friend. I wonder what that means to you. What is that looking like in terms of your time in this life, in pursuit of being a friend, being in friendship?
Growing up, I had friends, like school friends, and I had best friends and all that, but I also hid a lot, you know, and my family was a family that hid things. We hid what was happening. We hid where we lived. I had one person spend the night at my house my whole life, one friend spend the night at my house. So I learned to hide more than I learned to befriend. And I mean, I can't speak totally for my siblings. I think, you know, they're more skillful in other ways than I am. But I think the general mood of our family is to like be together. We're kind of trauma bonded in that way, and to not really reveal yourself in friendship. So it's been a journey of most of my adult life to figure out how to be friend, how to receive friendship. And to me, friendship is like other people along the path with you, people that journey alongside you, that you help out if they fall, that help you out if you fall, just a mirror, a companion, accompaniment along the path. And that really requires that I heal a lot of the deeply ingrained isolation and hiding that I learned so well. I mean, I became an expert at it at a really young age. So I'm really learning how to be a friend, and it's a deep commitment I'm in right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think too about the inherent vulnerability in that, right? And that a part of vulnerability means that there's an exposure and there's risk and exposure in that way. And that, at least for me, in the ways that I think about friendship and the ways that I aim to practice friendship and kinship and all of its ways in my life, I think about a practice of yielding, yielding to care and to support, and what a practice that is when you've been taught to hide.
And I have to say, I mean, I don't know how much you talk about yourself personally on this podcast, but I've known you not fully a year yet, but I would look to you as an example of someone that I, you know, would learn from around friendship, just the way that you've done it with me and the way that I see you do it in your own community. I feel like it's a real teaching. I'm really in a moment of like, who are my models? Because I didn't get a lot of models growing up. Like, who are the people I can look at and go, you're doing it kind of the way that I want to do it. And I have to be compassionate with myself too about how the vulnerability that you're talking about. I just was talking to a friend the other day. I left him a voice memo. We had had a little rupture, pretty little rupture. And I said, I just need you to know that vulnerability to me is not just like, you know, it's not just like, oh, it's kind of a hard thing to do. I feel terrified to tell you how I was hurt, to say that I was hurt. And I need that terror to kind of be acknowledged. And he totally was capable of doing that and present for that. But that's part of it, I have to say. I feel terrified. And it may be irrational to go, I feel terrified to tell my friend that I'm hurt. But it doesn't make it any less true. So I'm just stepping into the terror a little bit more and finding that sometimes when I do that, I can be met.
Well, in that, right, I think in the vulnerability of even opening up a wound to say, here's something that I want to show you, or something I want to share with you, and I'm going to ask you to tend to this, that there's the risk that someone either won't tend to it with you, or something will happen as you've exposed a wound, right? Something that makes it worse. And one of the things that I was interested in being in conversation with you around was, and part of this came up because in your book, What It Takes to Heal, you tell the story about reaching a moment with your own health, where you tell the story of going to the doctor and having some issues with your heart. And it made me wonder, what is the time that you felt really, really deeply cared for, like a deep sense of belonging in that care? Because that was an incredibly vulnerable moment. For your body and in community.
Yeah, because, you know, the other part of all this care stuff is like, the care can be there, but if you're not receptive to it and you don't allow care to happen, you reject it, it can be really challenging. I mean, honestly, when I had the heart stuff come up, my partner, and a lot of it was stress-related, or I presume stress-related heart issues I was having, because I was just so, I mean, I was probably at the most stressful period of my life so far, and it was with my work. And my partner said, you're done. You can't do this anymore. I'm going to call the people at the organization and tell them that you are not doing this anymore. And she did that. And sometimes that's actually what I need, is someone to intervene on my behalf, because I will try to handle everything until the last moment. And she was like, I'm calling them and saying, you're done. And she took care of me. And when I wanted to jump up out of bed and not rest, she was like, lay your ass back down.
That's love.
It was love. I needed that because I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah. I'm recalling something that you said. I listened to your interview with Dean Spade, and you talked in that interview about relationships, the place that we're going to heal being at the site of relationship. And isn't that it right there? Right. That ultimate yielding to say, I may be in a moment of not making great decisions for myself or for my body. And like, who can I look to that's in proximity to me and that has deep love and care for me, that's going to say something like, you need to sit your ass back down.
Yeah. And don't we all just, I mean, I think part of the challenge we have is that we all want to like heal privately and then have like a debut as a healed person and no one will have seen the mess. And I think the mess and being revealed in the mess is so much of the work of like, here's the mess, here's where I'm confused, and I'm going to try to reach for you, or I'm going to accept your reach. And that is the move that actually transforms everything. But like many things, we feel so much shame around where we are still undone or confused or dysregulated, if you want to use that language. And I think then we miss out on why and how relationship is actually where we heal, when we reach for each other, when we're held, when we hold. We don't have to do it all privately and perfectly.
Yeah. Well, and in that, there's fear, right? There's the fear of, and you've talked about this too, that's noticing the ways that fear wants us to move away from one another. And what I hear you saying are the ways that we need to move towards one another in order to heal. And maybe that brings us to another question or curiosity that I have is, you talk about everything being a practice. I've heard you say that multiple times and in different ways. And that's something that, I really take from you as a teacher, is thinking more intentionally about the things that I practice, not just, you know. And I think one of the things that I've really taken away from hearing you talk about that is that it's not just a practice when it's yoga or meditation or something that we hold on some pedestal or hold in some high regard. It's a practice no matter what we do, you know. Avoidance is a practice. Picking up our phone is a practice. Whatever it is that we turn to, that's the practice. And the ways that fear can direct us can also become a practice. So I wonder, as you're in this pursuit of yours that you're describing of, you know, deepening in connection and healing and relationship, what is your practice around fear?
Well, I think another way maybe even to say that is like, what's my practice around courage?
Yeah.
Because the fear is absolutely there. And the fear is often the driver, like you said, towards isolation, towards my old patterning, towards the thing that I think will keep me comfortable and alleviate the fear. But what changes our patterns ultimately is the courage to feel that fear and do something different anyway. And you step into the unknown and you don't know what's going to happen, but it's the act of courage, of reaching, of me saying, I'm really afraid to say this, or just saying it, or I need help. And I don't even know what that means, but I need help. I need somebody to talk to. Those moments are when I'm afraid. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but it's an act of courage. I think everything that we do towards recovering aspects of ourselves that we've disowned, or that we've parts of our body that we vacated, every act we take where we work through and with the fear rather than succumb to the isolation that fear recommends. I think that those are the moments where we start to change our patterning, and we also start to change. It's like when I think about how I grew up and the way that I was taught to relate to people, as I grow up and keep reinforcing that pattern, that produces a certain outcome in my life relationally. And the only way I break out of that pattern is through taking these courageous acts on of revealing myself. And I think that's true on a, like an interpersonal level. I think it's true on a community level, on a societal level, that our repatterning comes from courageous moments of connection and not through that which brings us comfort.
Yeah.
You know, that false safety over and over again.
Right, right. This is stirring something in me because I've been at the very beginning phases of trying to reconnect with my ancestry in a different way, in a way that's less about rejection and distancing and more about reclaiming and connection. And one of the things that has come up for me in that process so far is this realization that the fear that drives us into isolation and disconnection, as you're talking about, is such a symptom, right, of a different time that we're in, that this is a symptom of things like capitalism, right, like the patriarchy and these other oppressive forces that we are navigating, fascism, and that our ancestors knew something different. They knew that when fear arose, that for the most part, it meant a turning towards each other, because interdependence was central, kinship was central. And I can't have this conversation without acknowledging the ways that a partner of mine teaches me about kinship all the time as a Native person, and the ways that they remind me that my job is to be in right relationship and to look to kin and ancestors for those teachings and those reminders. So I say all that also because I wonder what that might hit for you, or if that stirs something for you in terms of, you know, the kind of remembering that we might individually and collectively be in around connecting with our lineages in a way that says, hey, this fear is learned. This movement mm-hmm. towards isolation and disconnection is actually not ours.
Yeah, and talk about vulnerability. It's like a vulnerability in the sense of a danger, the turning away from each other. This is something I'm writing about right now, of like how our impulses to reach for each other, as an example, how that gets intercepted and co-opted by systems that both create. We talk about loneliness, for example. It's like, oh, we have a loneliness epidemic. It's both created by the culture, and then the culture tries to create a solution that separates us more. Mm-hmm. And it's actually more lucrative to create solutions that separate you more and more and more and more from each other, because then I can think of a million different products to sell mm-hmm. you, when the actual thing that provides deep resonance and connection doesn't cost anything. Mm-hmm. But we are more and more afraid of it. We're more and more turned away from it. So I think about that a lot. And this piece around lineage and ancestry, I think, is so important. If we just, one, I would just say, I think it's like really the practice of filling ourselves out. Like we are obviously the people that are here now, but there's some illusion. I think it like narrows who we think we are, not to be connected to that lineage, to that long tail, to that history. And it makes us, I think, in a way, much more fragile or susceptible when we're not filled out, more sturdy people. I know where I come from, and I know in that story there is sorrow, there's triumph, mm-hmm. there's exploitation, there's in all of our lineages. I am not personally, I'm not a romanticizer. I don't have that tendency, unfortunately, for people close to me. I know that in my lineage, when we talk about our ancestors, I don't want all of them to come. I don't want everybody to show up. Mm. They haven't done all their work.
Yeah. Yeah. Think about ancestors, right?
Yeah. It's like the ones that are like, I was holding on to this light for you. I was praying for you. I want those ancestors to come forward and support me and fill me out and remind me that I'm part of a long line. I am part of a trajectory. I'm part of a wave. I'm a particle in a wave. And I think that makes us much more mature. It's a much more appropriate time scale for me. Mm-hmm. I don't feel alone across time. And I think that is something that's necessary for all peoples. Like when we can talk to each other and we can hold the listening for our own histories and the listening for each other's histories, the conversation is just much more mature to speak to each other as those kinds of beings rather than these kind of like narrow, am I getting it right? Am I healing all generations? Am I, you know, like that kind of shakiness. I want to meet you as someone that can hold the complexity of your history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just even in listening to that last part, I think about the difference between doing something with some spaciousness versus doing it in that really contracted state. And I know that you and I are both somatics practitioners, so there's probably a different way that we understand that, even as I say that. And some folks who listen to this won't be as familiar, and I'm interested in inviting them into knowing that too. So I wonder, even when you use the language of being filled out, what does that mean?
On one level, it's perception, like what you perceive yourself to be. Do you perceive yourself to be primarily kind of running full speed towards your life, always late, on the edge of you, just kind of like coming out of your eyes, only front body, moving forward, which I think is the encouraged way of being. It's like, got to move faster, got to have my latte, got to have my, and I'm not knocking that, but you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That kind of forward of your center energy.
Yeah.
Always late to life, rather than, to me, what is a filled out presence is like, I can feel my back, I can feel what comes before me, I can feel the inside of my body, I can even feel the front in this moment. And with that dimensionality that I allow myself are all sorts of capacities of like self-trust. I don't have to rush everything. I'm not failing everything. It's okay. I can relax into the trust that I have what I have. I have maybe what I need, but what I got is what I got. I'm going to bring what I got to the moment. Mm-hmm. I am this body, and I'm also this lineage. I can feel that somehow, and it relaxes me. It's not all on my one life. And I meet the moment. I try to be as present as I can in the moment. And that means I have to relax into it a little bit. I have to like allow myself to perceive this moment as it is. So it's a way that I sit in my own body and sit in my own life. There's a way that we're trained to be in our lives, and you have to, you know, I always ask this question when I do a training, who does your embodiment serve? The way that you sit in your body, the way that you look through your eyes, the way that you breathe, the way that you move, who does it serve? Because a lot of us are rushing and we don't realize that it either serves some old story maybe our parents had or our grandparents had, or it serves people that would like to extract as much as they can from you. Is there another way of living in your life and living with presence? And who would that serve? Because to me, my presence serves my child. It serves my own life. It serves my friendships, et cetera. So that's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about just a moment ago, you were talking about arriving to life late at the same time that you were describing someone moving forward of their center, right? And I had this image of someone like head first, almost like running across a finish line, you know, the way that people lean forward to hit the tape in a race faster. Yeah. And the irony in that, right? That like there's this socialized thing that happens where we're taught that getting to the finish line first is the ultimate accomplishment. But what did we miss? What did we miss in pacing along the way and taking in what surrounds us and being in relationship along the way?
And what is the finish line? Death?
Are we what is it? Yeah.
It seems like it. I mean, if we pull back and look at the culture and we're like, what are we racing towards? Oh. Yeah.
Right.
Is that what I want to race towards?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not me.
Yeah. Well, and even the ways that the race itself brings us there faster.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It is the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a way that I kind of want to bridge this conversation into another curiosity. One of my favorite things about these conversations that I get to have is learning about some significant moment or experience in someone's life and the way that that has influenced them in some way. Is there some moment that you can think of or some experience that comes to mind that moved you? Something that, that changed something for you? It had some sort of significant impact on your life or your experience of the world?
So many.
It's a beautiful thing to have a lot to choose from. It's a cool thing even to watch you just think about it.
Really?
Yeah,
you
kind
of see it on my face.
Yeah, because I think about, I'm a process person, right? I love orienting to process more so than where we end up. And what's the process of making a choice?
Yeah, I'm so thankful that I've had moments like that, you know, where things have deeply shifted for me. Well, I have to say that, like, writing the book had like 20 different moments that changed me in it. And actually, you know, I went to, I think it was 2018, maybe, I went to Paris. As I'd asked my friend, I was like, where does one go to write? And like, I want to sit in a cafe and write. And my friend is from London. And she was like, Paris, naturally. Like, you have to go to Paris.
Obviously. Yes.
Yeah. And I left basically a week after I had finished being on staff at BLM. And I got this little apartment. It was full of books. And I was like, okay, I'm going to spend 2 weeks. I'm going to write about all the things that I know. This is 2018.
Yeah.
And I spent 2 weeks eating baguettes and crying.
That's its own form of writing. Yeah.
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 And looking back, I'm like, you thought you were just going to sit down and write a book after, like, you know, being a part of BLM for all those years, you thought you had processed anything at all about that experience? So I didn't write, but I did go on night walks to all the places where James Baldwin used to frequent. And I don't know Paris, so I don't know if I should be walking around in certain places, but I went every place where this is the first apartment he had, and this was the place where he used to hang out with his friends in Paris. And I would just go there at night and talk to him on walks. And I asked for his help, and you know, I just tried to listen to stories of him. I asked people about him who might know him. I went past the restaurant that he would always go to. And partly I'll just say that what I had to learn and what he taught me was I had to self-authorize myself. I had so much doubt and stories that told me that I couldn't know, that I didn't know, that I wasn't smart enough. And this is one of the burdens of racism, really. That message got in so early that I wasn't smart enough to do what I was doing. And so I talked to him a lot about that. And what I came to is I really had to authorize myself to know what I know, to say what I know. Well, then the whole completion of the book has been its own thing, but that was a big turning point for me.
Yeah. Are you willing to share a little bit about your conversations with him, about what they looked like, what they sounded like?
Sure. I went to his house. Is now they're turning it into condos. Folks tried to preserve it, but they refused to. So I went to the site of his house and I basically just asked him like about his love of the truth and his commitment to the truth and how he, basically a question about courage, like how he worked through his fear of disappointing people, of angering people, of being ostracized, et cetera, et cetera. Because the thing I love about James Baldwin, more so than really any writer, is that he does not let anybody off the hook. And what I mean by that is he can speak so clearly to the human dynamics of hierarchy, especially around race, less so about gender, but he doesn't romanticize anything either. He doesn't give any of us a safe place to be or to hide, which is so hard because you want that. You want to say, I've endured this thing. I have the scars of this thing. And I want to know that I'm good. I want to know that I'm good. And he never did that exactly. It was pure love and clarity. So I talked to him about how to do that, how to not be afraid of the people that would want me to say something different. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that I escaped that fully. I think, you know, in writing this next book, I'm grappling with that question a lot more of like, can I let myself disappoint people to say what is true to me? Yeah. But that's what he helped me with.
Yeah. It's interesting because I had a reaction to you even asking that question, which was, of course you can, because you do things with so much love. And when I think about my experience of his writing, I think about the intensity of the truth that he shares, but my sense, and I almost have this image that I see a photo of him so often, is this leaning towards. Mm-hmm. And it feels like that too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think his truth also feels like I'm doing this in the pursuit of building a bridge and connection and in the pursuit of something different in the future that looks like more love and looks like more liberation. And I really feel that with you too.
Thank you.
I mean, speaking of ancestors, right? I mean, there's this way that I think we maybe lose the creative pursuit of connecting with ancestors and thinking about how there's so much that we carry in our bones and our being that we need an invitation to remember by being in connection with ancestors, whether there are blood relatives and lineage, or if they are queer and trans ancestors, if they are ancestors of a different kind, and, you know, in movement, whatever it might be, that the invitation is there. And really it's up to us if we're going to take the invitation to participate in that kind of remembering by being in that kind of conversation like you were with him.
Yeah. It's like why, you know, Alexis Pauline Gums is another Durham resident and incredible scholar, writer,
amazing
visionary.
Work.
She is in almost constant communication with ancestors. And I learn a lot about the audacity to communicate, to talk with ancestors through her, because she does not, she has full faith that ancestors will answer. So she'll wake up, you know, 4 a.m. and she'll be like, and then, you know, Audre Lorde wanted to tell me something this morning. So I got up and I read it. And right there, it's exactly what I needed. Wow. You know, she gave it to me. So I'm like, the kind of faithfulness to know, she's like, I don't have to even guess at this thing because my ancestors were already talking about this, thinking about this, and left me information. Yeah, I try to move a little bit more like that. It's, I am not as faithful in a way as she is, but it's lovely to be in community with people that are, because it makes me feel like, okay, I can give myself permission to seek connection, to listen to their words, to listen to their lives and the things that they grappled with and how they did it. and learn from them, learn from them. Learn. I mean, she learns not just through what they say, but how they said it, when they said it, the conversations they had with other people, and just to really honor a life of grappling, learning, expression, listening.
Yeah.
Yeah. To fill them out right? As well as fill ourselves out.
Yeah. Well, and that's the kind of right relationship that I think about. That's not about extraction. You know, when we can hold someone's context and, as you say, fill them out. I love that. I need to really turn that language inwards and really, really think about and sit with that. But the filling out process of someone, contextualizing them, understanding them in their environment, in their time, in their own relationships, and the ways that that really helps us understand them differently. And, you know, Prentice, you're doing this for people. You know, I think about the ways that you are filling out, but filling out in such a generous way that other people get to connect with through what you write, through what you share in your practices, and all the different ways that people intersect. It's interesting, right? Because I say that in the phrase that was about to come out of my mouth is through your work. And I'm like, right. And that's a true way maybe to describe what I'm trying to describe. But the other piece is just like how you're existing, right? And the way that you're moving through the world and in relationship, and the ways that you are filling out and allowing people to be in contact with that and to be in relationship with that, which is a really generous offering. When I take a moment to even fill you out in what you have shared with me and thinking about your family's history of hiding and the ways that you are stepping out into the world in this way that allows us to really learn from and with you. We're so lucky for that.
Thanks. I mean, you want to set yourself out to be a good ancestor, to be useful. Mm-hmm. To the future. And I mean, and trying to be a good parent, honestly, that's a whole other journey. Like, that one's much more immediate. I'm like, okay, I can mostly go in this life. I tried, but I got to do it, you know, in the morning, getting ready for school. I got to try to be that too. I'm grateful to have been able to express myself as much as I have in this life. And I'm working to have my expression be as honest as I can be, because I feel the pull towards an authenticity that is so central to our culture. I'm really trying to be myself. Yeah. And I hope that resonates. And even if it doesn't, I hope that I can be satisfied with just being honest.
Yeah. That's a worthy pursuit. I feel that. Yeah. I think one of the best compliments we can give and receive is that we experience someone as authentic.
Yeah.
Because then it's real. Yeah. Yeah.
That's my favorite.
Yeah.
There's no better compliment to me.
Agreed. Yeah. I am a chronic rejecter of compliments, but if I get that one, I take a moment and take a breath and receive it.
I have seen this.
Okay. Maybe one last question. I have had the great pleasure of laughing much with you. And I want other people to know a little bit about that side of you too. So I wonder, what does your practice look like around play right now, around joy?
Okay, the second favorite compliment that I've ever received outside of being authentic was I just did this event. It's like a global majority menopause conference Omi Sade, Bernie Scott put on here, Black Girl's Guide to Menopause. And I did a somatics workshop there. And afterwards, someone came up to me and they were like, that was so funny.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh. And they said, no, that was like stand-up comedy, like funny. I was laughing. And I was like, this is the best compliment. Because I'm sort of going for that when I do workshops, not to distract, but to soften. I love making people laugh, and even about things, not in a disrespectful way, but laughing the kind of cosmic laugh together. Mm-hmm. The kind of like, look at this predicament. Sometimes all you can do is laugh. That really, really matters to me, that there's joy, because sometimes this work can be so heavy and so serious and so hard. Mm-hmm. Look, we still cry over here. We still yell and thrash. We still do all that. But there also is that belly laugh available to us that I think is that rhythm of life that reconnects us to each other, and the joy that is to me the undercurrent. So I like to laugh a lot, and it's been hard for me to figure out how to share that part of myself, you know, because I'm often just like talking about something serious. But that is really the core of me, is that joy and that laughter. And I play a lot. You know, I do have a kid. I have to sometimes go, you know what? Stop thinking about what you have to do. Stop thinking about what's next and just be a pirate. Like, be fully a pirate. We just made a film this weekend where I discover a mermaid, and the mermaid is my kid washed up on the shore. This is like full go in. So that full is another play. Way of, you got to get in there with life and just like laugh at it all. Not, don't get too attached or too over identified with it. Yes, it's all real. Yes, it's heartbreaking and hurts. And yes, too, that there's a magic in a belly laugh with somebody, a belly laugh with a child, a belly laugh with an elder. When my kid grabs my face and just laughs and laughs at something I said, that can carry me for weeks.
Yeah.
You know, so that's really important to me.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I think, too, about if we come back to that, if you're leaning so far front of your center, you're not in the moment enough to like be the damn pirate for a minute. You know,
that's right.
Go find the mermaid.
You gotta be a pirate. You gotta be the mermaid. Go fully in. I mean, I have a costume, so I get in.
I love it. That's great. Thank you, Prentice. I'm so grateful, as always, to be in space with you, in relationship with you, and for you to share all this with everyone who gets to benefit from listening to you. Something that I'm doing with the podcast is every guest gets to choose an organization that I'll donate to on their behalf. So
cool.
I wonder if there's an organization that comes to mind that you'd want to tell us a little bit about.
Sure. Let's see. One organization I'd love for you to donate to is the Carolina Federation, which is an organization here in North Carolina that is, it's a statewide organization building political power for our communities here. And there are a lot of chapters. There's a lot of just real community investment that we're running candidates. We're trying to build real political power. And I think we have to support those projects that are trying to create a new future and are really looking to our communities who know best to figure out how we can govern ourselves and build the collective future that we need. So that's what I'd say.
Beautiful. I love it. Thank you. Of course, if you haven't read Prentice's book yet, What It Takes to Heal, buy it, but then buy like 3 extra copies, because I promise you, you'll want to gift it to your closest people so you can be in conversation about it. I know that I have worn out the cover of that book and lined many pages. So thank you, Prentice. I'm grateful to have spent this time with you.
Thank you so much. It's always lovely to see you, Mariah.
Prentice embodies a solidity that invites me and us all into deeper connection with our bodies and with one another so that we can show up more fully in our lives and in the world. In this conversation, they remind us of the transformative power of friendship, the liberating work of becoming embodied, and how by doing the work to intentionally connect with our ancestors, we can move forward more wholly. Thank you so much for joining us for this very first episode of Moved. We've got an unbelievable season planned for you with conversations with musicians, authors, artists, spiritual leaders, and activists, all sharing moments that move them and the ripple effects that they create in the world. Make sure you're following the podcast wherever you listen and follow along on Instagram. Our second episode next week features Willow Defabaugh, author, fellow podcast host, and editor-in-chief of climate and culture magazine Atmos. Moved is created by me, your host, Mariah Rooney, production by Isabel Robertson, music by Joshua Roman, with writing support from Emily Long and community building support from Rachel Hornstein.